plantations for slaves. This was a hugely profitable enterprise. These were the original hunters of humans.
Now, illegal logging in Cameroon, the largest exporter of tropical timber to Europe, is posing a real threat to the country's forests that are its most valuable economic and ecological resource. Now, Professor Manji, you mentioned about land grabbed by European multinationals in Africa, leaving little for humans and wildlife. Can you elaborate further on this, please?
They destroy large amounts of land in order to privatize it. And we've seen this continuity under neocolonialism. Under the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF and so on, what you see now is even greater grabbing of land.
High consumption in rich, developed countries is driving forest destruction in many parts of Africa. Ancient forests are being destroyed to plant crops or raw material destined for Europe. For instance, to satisfy the European appetite for chocolate, massive forests have been destroyed in Ivory Coast to clear the way for cocoa plantations. According to estimates, in the last 50 years, the country has lost 90% of its forest cover. Cocoa was the main reason for this destruction. Why did Prince William conveniently ignore the fact the European consumption habits are responsible for the destruction of wildlife habitat in Africa?
The paradigm of these racists, because let's be quite clear, his whole framework is fundamentally racist, is to always blame the blacks. It's always blaming Africans.
Many agree that capitalism greed leads to the pollution of our air and water, soil degradation, deforestation, and the destruction of biodiversity.
The first step is to recognize that regardless of what particular variety of capitalism you're facing, capitalism is destroying the living planet. And if it's a sort of social democratic capitalism, it might take a few years longer than if it's a neoliberal capitalism. But it's still heading in exactly the same direction.
According to the United Nations, Africa only contributes 2-3% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. Yet Prince William says African population growth is responsible for environmental destruction. Now, Professor Manji, what's your opinion on these?
Well, it's clearly wrong. It's not what is causing environmental destruction. The scale of environmental destruction carried out by mining companies, for example, especially Canadian mining companies across Africa, have huge impact in towards creating the conditions.
Now, the remarks by Prince William are not the first by a European leader. Now, in 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron faced backlash for talking about Africa having a civilizational problem because women are having 7 or 8 children. Now, Professor Manji, do you think the remarks by these European leaders are part of a long-term imperialist strategy of depopulation in African countries?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen so many examples of the use of things like Depo-Provera, enforced sterilization. This is not something that's in the past. It is going on today. Enforced sterilization, often done secretly to women, is something quite outrageous. But it fits within this racist paradigm that you get from the discourse of these social parasites like Prince William, who can only see the fear that they have and that they are part of an inheritance. As I said at the beginning, his wealth comes from a long line of enslavement of humans. You know, and that was a massive, massive depopulation strategy for Africa.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Manjik, for your insight. We now take a short break before the second part of our show that will focus on United States economic sanctions on African countries refusing to toe Washington's line. Stay with us.
U.S. trade weapon in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United States has cut Ethiopia, Mali, and Guinea out of a duty-free trade program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, over alleged human rights violations and recent coups.
Ethiopia's trade ministry said in November it was extremely disappointed by Washington's announcement, saying the move would reverse economic gains and unfairly affect and harm women and children.
For more insight on how the U.S. is using trade agreements to arm twist African countries, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, the U.S. claims to care for the common people, yet its move against these three African countries will affect ordinary people. This is a classic case of collective punishment, which is common in U.S. foreign policy. Now, what's your take on this U.S. policy?
Absolutely. I think the removal of these countries from the African Growth and Opportunity Act is a form of sanctions. And sanctions are economic warfare that have, you know, devastating human costs. Like you said, you know, it is collective punishment that are part of the strategy of, you know, enforcing compliance. So by design, you know, the removal of these countries, right, like Mali, Guinea, and Ethiopia, that will affect, you know, ordinary people in these countries and, you know, particularly rural women who, you know, work in, you know, manufacturing sectors. They'll be the ones who'll suffer.
Economic sanctions and embargoes have become the tool of choice to respond to governments opposed to the meddling by the United States in their countries. Canadian international criminal law expert John Philpott, in an interview with an Addis Ababa TV network, said the U.S. decision to remove Ethiopia from the African Growth and Opportunity Act privileges is meant to hurt the people and weaken the government of Ethiopia.
U.S. intention is to hurt the people. They want the people to hurt. They apply sanctions around the world and cause terrible suffering, starvation, lack of medicine. And in your country, they want to hurt your country so it's weaker, and so maybe the people will turn against the government. That is their thinking and their plan.
Is the United States using trade with Africa as a tool to spread its imperialist and hegemonic control over African countries?
The U.S.'s unparalleled dominance over global finance and trade allows them and their allies to essentially own the world economy. With the complicity of the World Bank, you know, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, that dominance is, you know, reinforced and expanded, and it allows the U.S. to selectively and unilaterally exclude you know, any country at any time from participating in the global economic system. And so what we're seeing is that, you know, through this African Growth and Opportunity Act, you know, Mali and Guinea and Ethiopia are, you know, being excluded from participating in trade with the U.S. specifically. And, you know, and like I was saying earlier, this is, you know, kind of a form of sanctions. It's, you know, the U.S. and the European favored form of exerting control over the world.
Now, the recent U.S. meddling in Ethiopia, where it was seen as supporting the TPLF rebels, attracted condemnation by Ethiopian officials and the masses. Mali has also adopted a new policy and increased its engagement with Russia and other Eastern countries. Now, can we say that the reason these countries such as Mali and Ethiopia are being targeted by the U.S. sanctions is because of their decision to ignore orders from Washington and other Western countries?
You know, the crime of these countries is, you know, using their own resources to develop their own, you know, social progress rather than following the dictates of the U.S. and following the capitalist path. That's why they're singled out for these sanctions. And I think, you know, we should also understand that sanctions don't defend justice or human rights. They're illegal, they're immoral, and they're really terrorist acts of war that are applied against civilians, right, and inflict the greatest suffering on the most vulnerable, including children, including women, you know, the disabled. And so we should see this for what it is. I mean, I'm not saying that the African Growth and Opportunity Act is, you know, the most ideal arrangement or initiative or relationship between these countries and the U.S., but I think we should see this action as a form of sanctions and understand what those sanctions are.
Ethiopians worldwide responded to the U.S. interference in their country's internal affairs by organizing protests that have clearly angered the Biden administration. Here's one such demonstration in London.
No more!
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 Resist!
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 Prevail!
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 Endure!
Endure! Resist!
Resist!
Endure!
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 Prevail!
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 Ethiopia!
Ethiopia!
Will prevail!
Will prevail!
We have seen Ethiopian protesters vowing to resist U.S. meddling in their country. Can African countries sustain this resistance to U.S. pressure?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the No More movement is a great development. And what I'm aware of is that African people are constantly rising up. They're constantly resisting, even if we don't see that reflected in mainstream media. But I think what we should understand is that, you know, wherever there's oppression, there's resistance. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, imperialist oppression on the African continent. And so as a result, there's a lot of resistance on the part of African countries or African people, rather.
The United States has been selective in enforcement of the AGOA violations. This is while previous U.S. regimes have ignored violations committed by other AGOA beneficiaries. Some experts say the U.S. targeting of countries such as Ethiopia could backfire.
And if you really see the import value, the import value from U.S. to Ethiopia is much higher than the export value from Ethiopia to the U.S. It means that U.S., if they close the export market from Ethiopia, we would naturally close the import market from U.S. That means U.S. is at a bigger loss than Ethiopia. You know, in terms of the balance of trade, there is a concept called balance of trade. That is the difference between export and import.
China and Russia are already moving in to fill the U.S. gap in African countries. Do you think Washington's disengagement could be a blessing in disguise?
I think that is very likely. The U.S. is already in decline on the world stage, and moves like this that weaken its relationships with countries on the African continent can only accelerate that decline. The U.S. already lags behind China in terms of trade with the African continent. You know, China's investing heavily in African infrastructure through its Belt and Road Initiative and its forgiving debt that's been demanded by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And so if China and now Russia are now increasing their influence in Africa, it's really because Africans see the advantage of having an alternative to the U.S. and to Washington. And I believe that these African countries have every right to do business with their allies themselves, with the states of their choosing.
Now, despite claims by the U.S. that AGOA will bring about change and improve the everyday lives of Africans, poverty remains widespread in the region amid sluggish progress and other mounting shortcomings. Now, Mr. Osazua, what should African countries do to avoid being vulnerable to U.S. pressure, as we have seen in the case of AGOA?
Right, like we need to see really a mass movement, right, for a united Africa. And I think we've already started to see, you know, initiatives on the part of African countries for, you know, greater unity, for unification. But it's really what I would like to see, what I think would be the most useful in terms of fighting back against, you know, U.S. and Western domination, is really, you know, a mass movement for unified socialist Africa that would, you know, really meet the needs of African people in ways that don't rely on initiatives or programs like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, right? Like, Africa should not be dependent on, you know, Western aid or neoliberal development projects like the African Growth and Opportunity Act. We need, you know, initiatives, we need programs, we need development, initiatives that are seeking to improve the lot of African people en masse.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs real unity to avoid dependence on exploitative economic programs such as AGOA imposed by Western countries. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde. Well, on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Take care and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, development and growth of religious community. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the topic of development and growth of the religious community in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic texts, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized on the marriage and through legal ways of the marriages. And the development and growth of the religious community can be obviously gained through the marriages, through having more kids, through having a big community, and this big community or number of people can have a better development and the growth of religious community. Therefore, when we look at the narrations of the Prophet, we see that the Prophet has said that مَا بُنِيَ بِنَاءٌ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ أَحَبُّ إِلَى اللَّهِ تَعَالَى مِنَ التَّزْوِيجِ, that there is no foundation in the Islam which is better than or which is more loving near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, near God, and that is the tazweej, and that is marriage. Why marriage is being given so much importance is because the marriage is a bound between a male and female, a legal bound by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and through this the generations are generated. The next generations will continue because of these bounds, these legal bounds. And when there is a legal bound, obviously we will have pure generations. And why? Because this legal bound is a pure bound, and it results in the pure generations, not unpure generations. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of development and growth of religious community. And one of the main important aspects is that this community should grow on the basis of purification. And the purification in the society comes with the legal bounds. It comes with the legal marriages and not adultery or something which has become a trend, especially in the Western community, and also it is having its effects on the Eastern world as well, which is the relationship between a boy and a girl without having a marriage, which they call being a boyfriend or girlfriend. This is not legal according to Islam, and we can see that in the Western societies there are many kids who are the results of this friendship which was between a male and female, a boy and a girl, and maybe they were together for 3 months, 6 months, or maximum 1 year, and then they basically had finished their relationship. But this relationship resulted in having some kids or a kid, and obviously this is not legal according to Islam. Islam talks about the responsibility. Islam says you cannot just have kids without having any responsibility, like not taking the responsibility of the kid. Therefore, Islam says that between male and female, if there is a relation, if they want to have friendship, that is the marriage. And through this marriage, obviously, they cannot go away from what they have done. And this marriage, which is a pure relation between the man and woman, and they become husband and wife, it results in pure generations, the children who are pure, and these generations can lead the nations in the pure way, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The limelight.
As the Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May, people across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of Israeli regime's crimes. But Meta and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nasser, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How Meta or Facebook Helps Israeli Regime Hide Its Crimes. Stay tuned for more. As the Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May, people across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of the Zionist regime's crimes. But Meta, or Facebook, and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. A new report by Human Rights Watch confirms that the two social media platforms, both owned by Meta, did indeed suppress and remove content in many cases, erroneously or unjustifiably. But Meta's acknowledgement to HRW of errors and unjustified removals was, at best, insufficient. It failed to address the scale and scope of reported content restrictions or adequately explain why they occurred in the first place, the watchdog said. Last week, Facebook, or Meta, announced it was hiring an outside consultancy to investigate accusations that it was censoring content favorable to Palestinians. There is plenty of evidence of suppression for the investigators to look into. In the period May 6 to 19, which includes the Zionist regime attack on Gaza, Palestinian digital rights group Hamlet denounced 500 instances of Palestinians' speech rights being violated online. They include removing content, account closures, blocked hashtags, and altering reachability of specific content. The vast majority of these violations, around 85%, occurred on Meta and Instagram, including the deletion of stories. Almost half of takedowns were done without prior warning or notice, and another 20% did not specify the reason for the removal. In one instance, Instagram restricted the use of hashtag Al-Aqsa in English and Arabic, which refers to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. After Hamlet challenged the company, the hashtag was reinstalled. Hamlet also observed an increase in geo-blocking on Meta technology that restricts access based on a user's location. Some posts that Instagram purged were simply reposts of content from major media organizations that could not remotely be construed as inciting violence or hatred. But Instagram labeled them as such, suggesting that the platform is restricting freedom of expression on matters of public interest, according to Human Rights Watch. Even when social media companies recognized errors and restored content, the damage was already done. Human Rights Watch said the error impedes the flow of information concerning human rights at critical moments. The group called for an external probe into Meta suppression practices. In one instance, Meta removed a post by a user in Egypt with more than 15,000 followers. The user had shared an Al Jazeera news item about the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. Initially, Meta deleted the post under its Dangerous Individuals and Organizations Community Standard, which prohibits specific organizations and individuals from having a presence on the platform. Meta later restored the post after the case was reviewed by its oversight board. The board concluded the post continued no praise, support, or representation The oversight board also criticized the weakness of the policy and demanded that Meta explicitly define what constitutes praise, support, or representation. The oversight board is sometimes critical of company policy and claims to be independent, but alarms were raised last year when Meta appointed former Israeli official Amy Palmer as a member. Palmer spent years at the Zionist regime's justice ministry enforcing censorship of Palestinians' speech. Human Rights Watch urged Meta to publish its dangerous individuals and organizations list, a recommendation previously made by the Oversight Board, but Meta has consistently refused to do so, claiming it would harm its employees. Recently, The Intercept published a leaked version of the list. It names over 4,000 people and groups, including politicians, writers, charities, hospitals, hundreds of music acts, and long-dead historical figures, The Intercept reported. The list of those Meta deems dangerous largely coincides with those the United States and the Zionist regime regard as enemies, but it goes much further than that. It includes the deceased 14-year-old Kashmiri child, Mudassir Rashid Perey, over 200 musical acts, television stations, a video game studio, airlines, the medical university working, and a long list of figures, The Intercept said. As well as Hamas and its military wing, the list includes the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime considers virtually all Palestinian political parties to be terrorist organizations, a pretext to routinely arrest Palestinians for political activity. Even though the Zionist regime military regularly commits massacres of entire Palestinian families, crimes against children, extrajudicial executions, and forced expulsions, it is not deemed dangerous enough to make it to Meta's list. And the Zionist regime still regularly uses Meta to threaten more violence. For instance, the Zionist regime military habitually posts direct threats of collective punishment against 2 million Palestinian civilians in Gaza. In May, the Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz used Meta to threaten more destruction than he ordered in Gaza in 2014. Back then, as the Israeli regime's army chief, he commanded a 51-day assault that killed more than 2,200 Palestinians, including 551 children. "Gaza will burn," Gantz said in a video posted on Meta in May, a direct threat that likely constitutes evidence of premeditated intent to commit war crimes. He says in the video over the footage of destruction, "Gaza residents, the last time that we met on Eid al-Fitr, I was chief of staff during Operation Protective Edge. If Hamas does not stop its violence, the strike of 2021 will be harder and more painful than that of 2014, he promised. The bigger question is why Meta, which has nearly a third of the world's population on its platform, is able to decide what or who is dangerous. It appears, as Columbia University professor Joseph Massad has recently written, that the criteria for who or what is considered dangerous or a terrorist depends more on a person's identity rather than what they do. It is not the act of terrorism that defines the actor as terrorist, but rather the opposite. It is the perpetrator's conferred identity as terrorist that defines his or her actions as terrorist in nature, Massad says. Meanwhile, as Meta cracked down on Palestinians, the Israeli Jewish extremists used instant messaging services to organize mob attacks on Palestinian citizens of occupied territories. This included Facebook or Meta groups, the Meta-owned service WhatsApp. There is no indication Meta takes this sort of misuse of its platform seriously while banning Palestinian political groups, journalists, and discussion at the Zionist regime's behest. Long before the Zionist regime assault on Gaza in May, Meta was habitually taking down pages of Palestinian news organizations, often without prior notice or justification. Last year, Meta even removed a page of the health ministry in Gaza, a vital source of information for people there. It was restored following inquiries from the Electronic Intifada, but the censorship does not seem to be enough. U.S. media and political elites have been demanding increasing control and censorship of social media platforms in recent years. The initial pretext was the evidence-free allegations that Russia had used social media, including Meta, to manipulate the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
امروز هم مستکبران از نام او وحشت دارن از یاد او وحشت دارن ببینید تو فضای مجازی اطلاع دارید حد بیشتر از من نبود که چه برخوردی دارن با اسم او میکنن
Today too the arrogant powers are intimidated by the name and memory of Shahid Qasim Soleimani Notice how they are treating his name on the internet You probably have more information than me in this regard This is another alert and even more of a signal for us and for the officials in charge of matters related to the internet in the country for them to understand what they should do in order to prevent the enemy from doing whatever he wants on the internet wherever he wants. Well, the internet which exists in the world today is in the hands of the arrogant powers. They are even afraid of his name and they are terrified of there being more people like him. This is what a role model is. They are afraid more people will be like him.
دنیا
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
او شهید سلیمانی موندنی است، تو ابد زنده است. اونایی که او رو شهید کردن، ترامپ و امثال او، جاشون زبالدان تاریخه.
In any case, Shahid Soleimani is eternal and will live on forever. Those who martyred him, Trump and the likes, belong to the dustbin of history. They will be among the forgotten ones in the trash can of history. But he will live on forever. A martyr is like this. His enemies will disappear, but of course, after having received retribution in this world for their crime, inshallah. I hope all of you, his honorable family, his friends and colleagues, and Mr. Qa'ani, who is working and moving forward very well, praise God, will follow and move forward on this path, inshallah. God the Exalted has promised victory to us. Allah indeed defends those who have faith. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 38. He has promised to defend those who believe. Well, we are moving on the path of the divine will and divine goals, and the nation is working for Islam. This is the promise of defense. There is another promise about assistance. Allah will surely help those who help his cause. إِن تَنْصُرُ اللَّهَ يَنْصُرُكُمْ وَيُثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَكُمْ. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 40. And in another verse it stated, if you help Allah, he will help you and make your feet steady. The Holy Quran, Surah 47, verse 7. I hope that all of you will be successful, inshallah. The activities that this woman spoke about, Zainab Soleimani, the daughter of Martyr Soleimani, are good activities. I hope all these activities will continue in the best way, inshallah. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing
is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration." Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Omar Lizki, Vienna.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by CAGE's outreach director Moazzam Beg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative. And yet I have not been convicted of any crime. I've never had my day in court. And I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Beg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Beg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst-hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions, while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor, Trump, had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet, affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August. Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Bahrain has a tiny population of 1.7 million, but boasts the highest prison population per capita. Thousands of those are political prisoners. Every family has members who have done time, and the stories of torture and abuse are harrowing. Human rights organizations and defenders have been documenting them for years.
There is multiple evidence of torture against both men and women who have been politically outspoken. And there are people who have been languishing in prison for 10 years now. Children who have had their teeth knocked out, they have been raped, they have had their genitals connected to electrical shock devices, car batteries or whatever, and have been driven around the villages, told that they would have their mothers or their sisters raped and violated if they did not snitch on their friends or the fellow villagers who would have been involved in the nightly protests against the continued abuse of fellow prisoners.
But this man, Omar Al-Hassan, the chairman of the Persian Gulf Center for Strategic Studies, has accused UK MPs and peers of making biased and fabricated criticisms of Bahrain. The kingdom's rulers are squirming in the wake of more and more criticism coming from Britain.
My lords, earlier this year I raised with the noble lord, Lord Ahmed, the detention of children in Bahrain following reports of their physical abuse and forced confessions.
My lords, a year ago this week, the Bahrain's courts upheld the death penalty for Mohammed Ramadan and Hussein Musa, following commitments made to do so in the other place by the Minister for the Middle East and North Africa. What representations has Her Majesty's government made to the government of Bahrain on the death penalty?
The GCSS says Bahrain's interventions show, quote, ignorance and disregard for the many achievements Bahrain has made and is proud of in terms of human rights. But the UK seems unfazed by this. The GCSS is notorious for defending Bahrain's human rights record, and its chairman, Omar Al-Hassan, stands accused of being in the pocket of the Bahraini embassy in the UK. According to Liberal Democrat Pierre Lord Scriven, the GCSS's claims are nothing more than a continuation of the amateurish and slapdash approach by the Bahraini authorities to try and deny their appalling human rights record and undermine or try to silence those of us who speak up. Nonetheless, the UK and Bahrain are strategic allies, and the UK is reluctant to turn words into actions when it comes to defending Bahrain's prisoners of conscience. This is just another example of the hypocrisy and double standards exercised by Western governments that benefit from maintaining the status quo. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week, it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters, forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
there is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly. But if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way